From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, it's a back-to-school edition of the program. We'll learn how older adults are helping MPS students improve their literacy skills. Then New Orleans remade its school system after Katrina, and education writer says what's happened since is important to understand.
So even though a lot of these changes occurred much quicker and at a much more wholesale rate in New Orleans than in other places, it really is illustrative of the kinds of debates and tensions being felt across urban America.
Plus, the greening of Marquette University.
That's one of the tenets, really, of Jesuit pedagogy, is that we're going to be wise stewards of Mother Earth's resources.
And what does it take to be a great teacher today? Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Good morning and welcome to Monday. Hope you had a nice weekend. It's the last week of summer vacation for many school students around the region. Others are already back to school. Some are entering their second or third week of classes, in fact. The past few months have been marked by modest gains in achievement for the area's largest school district. At a very basic level, reading proficiency scores reported in the spring improved slightly. But district officials conceded then that the numbers were still too low as MPS works towards the aims of its comprehensive literacy plan. As students head back to school, so are a growing core of volunteers who are tasked with helping students for whom reading is most difficult. The RSVP Tutor Program is a partnership between the school system and the organization Interfaith Older Adult Programs. As the school year is getting underway, we wanted to get some perspective from both sides of the equation. Heather Ashoff is volunteer coordinator for MPS, and Samantha Garrett is director of RSVP, which stands for Retired and Senior Volunteers Program for Interfaith. And we're joined by three tutors with the program, Keith McGaffey, Rosalie Greco, and Evelyn Ray Cowan. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start with a question for Heather Ashoff. How important is this work from MPS's perspective? Where is the help most needed?
We are so happy to have these volunteers in our classrooms on the academic side as well as the social side for our students to come in and work with a volunteer tutor, usually each week for an hour and a half, is such a great opportunity for our students to get extra support in the literacy training that they're receiving from their classroom, as well as just another friendly face in their building that students oftentimes look forward to.
What is the capacity to be able to handle volunteers and you know, how much of that capacity is met?
Yeah, so last year we had about 200 volunteer tutors through this program, which was fantastic. But we're looking to increase that number this year, shooting for a number around 250. So we're open to having more volunteers join the group that's returning this year.
And if I understand correctly, the work evolved out of a program that had originally paired up MPS with a recreation department. Is that right?
Yeah, so the program has gone through some changes over the years, but we've kind of been in this same model since 2011, and we think it works well for us. And maybe Samantha can jump in with some of that history.
Right, if you could, and talk about what makes this such a good fit from your perspective.
Well, Interfaith Older Adult Programs is the sponsor for RSVP, which is a national program. And so really what RSVP's mission is to engage older adults in the community to meet community needs. And so we have a really large school district in Milwaukee County that has the capacity to have people come in and help do something that is both meaningful for themselves as well as meaningful for the Milwaukee community. So as far as the history goes, we were given the opportunity to kind of revive MPS's 55-plus tutor program through Milwaukee Recreation. It just kind of started to, through various budget cuts, they just weren't able to sustain the program in the same way that they had in the past. And so they approached us with this opportunity. Over the years, we've kind of developed training and a strong partnership with MPS so that we could do all of the things that need to happen to get adults into the classrooms, which, you know, when you're working with students, there's all of those things like you need a background check and just telling people what to expect when they get there, because a lot of times people may have the desire to want to volunteer, but then what does that mean to you? You know, what do I need to do? What's the commitment? All of those things. And so Heather, on the volunteer side for MPS, has been able to create a strong partnership with us to make it sort of seamless for the volunteers.
Well, and let me put this question to each of our tutors that are with us. The education climate is much different today than it used to be, and certainly probably is different than when you were in school. Does it take some getting used to how things are done in the school system today?
For me, it was easy because I worked in the public school system. I was a teacher and an administrator. And then after I retired, I was looking for something that you could still make a difference in. And it, even though it wasn't at the same level that one would do as a teacher, as an administrator, this tutoring program was getting off the ground. And so I was very interested in going into schools and, you know, continuing. And what I found was that the training that they gave, the overall training, was very good for anyone coming into the system. And also they've set up a model whereby they try to have a lead tutor in schools to help support the tutor in schools. So I think it's a good environment for someone coming in.
And Heather, I mean, I imagine this is an issue for MPS. You don't just want any old tutor in a school, you want someone that you're pretty sure can do the job, right?
Yep. So after kind of initial screening of a background check, we pair up with Interfaith to do a 4-hour training. So that's something that discusses kind of what folks are going to see in a classroom, you know, what kind of materials they're going to handle, what they're going to see the teacher talking about, or the style that they're going to present it, because lots of times the classroom is very different than when these volunteers were in kindergarten or first grade themselves. So we want to make sure people are prepared and aware of what they're going to see.
Well, and what is exactly the kind of work that goes into literacy tutoring?
Speaking for myself and my background is in internal medicine, and in that capacity, you have to be both a good listener and a good communicator in order to help people with their health problems. And so my experience with the kids has been that the teacher selects who she wants me to work with, and I have a table out in the corridor, and I spend about 15 minutes with each kid, 6 kids in an afternoon. At the beginning, they're slow, and then they catch on. And so the process is my listening to where they are with reading and helping them move forward.
How about you, Evelyn?
Well, as far as my tutor session goes, I actually work with a group of 20 kids in a classroom, and I work around the workstations. So after a while, you actually get comfortable with the students and to what they're lacking in. So you try to just jump in, you know, whether it's them trying to read on their own, or whether or not you're helping them with, you know, learning their ABCs, or, you know, anything that the teacher can point out to you at the end of the day or prior to a class to say, hey, you know, maybe you want to help, you know, kid ABC because, you know, they need a little help in this area.
So the teacher, you know, prepares what they want the tutor to do. And I've seen a variety of different things that the teacher has asked the tutor to do, either to do at the work at the literacy stations like Evelyn is doing, to work in the halls, to work somewhere in the room. There's a variety of things.
What's the most challenging part of this?
I think the most challenging part is to really understand the students that you're working with. Each one of them presents their own challenge. For example, one of the students I had one year had just entered the third grade room from another school and was really struggling. The first few weeks were fine, but then he didn't want to work anymore. So I'm thinking, what can I do? And I said, what would you work for me? He said, a book. I said, a book. Perfect. I certainly can find a book, which I did at Barnes & Noble, and he worked, you know, for that. So once we got that established, then we had a good relationship.
Well, I wonder if one of the keys to this is not necessarily looking at the end goal, that this person is going to be a great reader, but smaller goals along the way.
Yes, exactly. You have to take little baby steps, and that's part of learning how to read is first to, you know, to learn your alphabet, to get into the phonetic sounds as well as you're reading the book. And there are times when you're reading to the child, but then it gets to the point where the child actually advances enough whereas they can read to you, and that is really a great feeling.
Do you feel like you are getting something out of this even as you are giving your assistance to these school children?
Most yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
We all know that education is in a state of flux in the United States, different opinions about the core program and how you get a child to learn, and recognizing some of them have a very difficult background, maybe a single parent, maybe a parent is out of work, what have you. And so you need to work with the individual child and assess where he or she is and proceed from there.
From MPS's perspective, what is the most important thing that you think these tutors bring to the job?
I think it shows support for obviously the students that get to build a relationship with the same adult week after week. So when they go through those struggles that every kid comes across while they're learning to read, they feel like they have a companion. They're not in it alone. They have somebody that's helping them out. I also think it shows a lot of support for our teachers and staff in the buildings to know that the community is coming in and interested in and values the work that's going on in those schools. So the academics, of course, but also that community support is a big piece of this too.
The kid, the individual child, feels that one-on-one. Here's somebody who's paying a total 100% attention to just me, whereas in the classroom they may feel left out because the teacher is paying attention to the other kids more than to him or her.
I know there are a variety of reasons for it, but this sort of speaks to the issue of larger class sizes.
Right, and the success of the students that you are working with. This past year, the teacher decided to focus on one particular aspect of literacy, fluency, and so started a program with a group of readers who weren't the top readers in the class, but gave me a new funny poem, humorous poem each week, which we talked to, and then at the end of the year, these students were able to present these poems to the entire class. So they were proud, the teacher was proud, I was proud. That's what we tutor for. We want to see those students succeed.
There's a lot of talk about support. What's the sort of support that the program itself offers the tutors as the school year goes on?
Well, we give them training in the beginning of the school year, but then we also offer monthly workshops for the tutors to come to. And the topics, you know, run the gamut of working on fluency or working on reading foundational skills. But then we also cover some of the social and emotional aspects of students because we really like the tutors to understand that there is more to what they're doing than just the academics, that, you know, they're building little people that need confidence and they need to feel like they love reading. So I often hear tutors say that I love to hear a kid say that they love working with me, but they love to hear even more a kid say, I love to read.
I was well aware that in my lifetime, and everybody else can say the same thing, you've been criticized or held in check for where you wanted to go in one direction, and the teacher or the parent said, no, that's out. And so I've concentrated on making sure to the best of my ability that each child has a good feeling after the session. So I praise them, I pat them, I high-five with them, and so on.
Given the relative success you've had with this program as it's structured, is there thought or are there other programs already that exist to work in other subject areas, math or social studies or science or anything else?
When we first set this program up, we had sights set on expanding or kind of replicating this model on the math side of the house. But we have really found that literacy is the great place to be, and we don't feel like the work is done yet on the literacy side of the spectrum. So we've decided to stick with that. We've got a couple of tutors who do have a passion or interest in math and science and have kind of taken to volunteering in those areas, but really there's enough work to do in literacy that we've stuck in that area. So our students are kindergarten up through fifth grade literacy.
Any last thoughts from our three tutors with us today?
Well, I just feel like it's a great opportunity for me to give back to the community. Myself, I'm an MPS graduate. I have three children that graduated through MPS as well. So I just feel blessed that I'm able to do this at this time in my life.
I'm sure we all have a strong feeling that we want to give back. We've received a lot in terms of our own education, and we see so many situations where the educational system has failed the child, and it's so important that they get a good, secure grounding so that they can go forward. I'm working with a couple of kids whose mother never finished school, and I would say she probably reads at a very elementary level herself right now. So to give her children that further opportunity is gratifying to her.
And I agree. And we can always use more tutors in our school. I have a school that's almost 800 kids. There's three of us tutoring right now. So we can always use more tutors and more teachers. In fact, I've asked my teacher, how can I get someone to come in my room? So the need is there and the work is good.
Well, Keith and Rosalie and Evelyn, thank you so much for your work. And Heather and Samantha, thanks so much for being with us as well.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Keith McGaffey, Rosalie Greco, and Evelyn Ray Cowan are all members of the Retired and Senior Volunteers Program at Milwaukee Public Schools. Samantha Garrett directs the program for Interfaith Older Adult Programs. She once worked on this very program. And Heather Ashoff is Volunteer Coordinator for MPS. There's a link to information about how to be part of the program at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. What education reform advocates in Wisconsin might learn from New Orleans. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. We're talking education during this back-to-school time of the year. The atmosphere of school choice in Wisconsin is the subject of study by people on many sides of the education reform debate in this country. But so is the experience of New Orleans, where the catalyst for education reform was Hurricane Katrina. Sarah Carr is an education reporter who formerly worked for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's also author of a book called Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. She joined us last year in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here.
Why is New Orleans such a useful example for examining issues of education reform?
You know, I think a lot of the tensions that are being felt in New Orleans are being felt in cities across the country. One's over the growth of charter schools, the right role for teachers' unions, and whether or not changes to the educational structure should emanate from within a community or be imposed from the outside. So even though a lot of these changes occurred much quicker and at a much more wholesale rate in New Orleans than in other places, it really is illustrative of the kinds of debates and tensions being felt across urban America.
Well, and can you set the stage for us a little bit? This was all a function of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. That this was certainly the catalyst for what you write about in mm-hmm. this book. Tell us what happened in Louisiana as a reaction mm-hmm. to Hurricane Katrina, and how it played out in the subsequent months and years mm-hmm. after the repopulation of New Orleans started.
Sure. There were two big changes that were made to the schools in the wake of Katrina. They had created what's known as the Recovery School District before the storm, but state officials used Katrina as an opportunity to significantly expand that. And so they pulled almost all of the city's public schools into the Recovery School District with the intent of chartering them as quickly as possible. Today, more than 80% of the city's public school children attend charters. And the other big shift was that they fired all of the teachers. Within days of Katrina, they put the teachers on unpaid leave, and then a few months later, they fired them. And so that has led to a significant shift in who's running and staffing the schools, and a big influx of young administrators and of teachers through alternative programs like Teach for America. So as you can imagine, those two big shifts were highly, highly controversial, but for good or for bad or for both, kind of led the way for a complete overhaul and revisioning of the public school system in New Orleans.
Your book takes this issue as it's playing out in New Orleans and filters it through three distinct lenses: a school principal, a relatively young teacher, and a girl who is just starting high school, and her family. What was it about those three categories in general, and maybe the specific people themselves, that spoke to the story that you were trying to tell?
Well, the main thing was that I wanted to tell the story of what happened from the vantage points of characters who had different perspectives from each other and also from myself to some degree. And so I knew that I wanted one of the main characters to be a student, because I feel like that's actually the least heard voice when talking about education, not only in New Orleans but across the country. I didn't want sort of one extreme or the other. I didn't want one who was sort of the top student in their class, but I didn't want one who, you know, was on the verge of dropping out from the moment I started following them. I wanted one who really could kind of go either way and who felt comfortable with me and who I connected with. And then in terms of the educators, since there is this big divide in New Orleans between veterans who were part of the schools before Katrina and the newcomers, I wanted one to be a veteran who had that perspective and context of knowing what it was like in the pre-Katrina school system. And I wanted one to be new to the city. And so I ended up focusing on, as you said, a veteran principal and a teacher who, when I followed him, who was in his third year and was an alum of the Teach for America program.
It seems like the simplest contrast to imagine would be in the differences between the experiences of this teacher, Aidan Kelly, who is this Ivy League and Teach for America alum, and the principal, Mary Laurie, who was a three-decade veteran of public schools. Mm-hmm. And yet it seemed as though there were similarities in their approach as well.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to sort of paint it, as you say, as like that they totally disagreed. And I think that the thing to me is I wanted people who came at this from sort of very humanistic, pragmatic lenses and not ideological ones. And I think the main similarity between Aidan and Mary Laurie to me is that they come at it from that humanistic perspective of wanting to do the best work for kids that they can, even though they have completely different life backgrounds and might not see sort of the reforms in the same exact way. I do feel like a lot of the conversation and debate over school reform has sort of been hijacked by ideologues, and that one of the main things my book offers is that is not sort of the perspective that is privileged throughout it.
In fact, you write very early on in this book that one of the problems that you see is that well-intentioned people with the same essential goal in mind aren't speaking the same language from the beginning.
I think I saw it. I first mentioned that language gap when writing about a scene where there was a dispute over a particular school building in New Orleans. And there was two African-American men who were very respected leaders in the community, one who wanted to give the school over to a charter and the operator, and the other who was adamantly opposed. And a lot of the pro-charter reform advocates likened their efforts to the civil rights movement of the 21st century in America. And this leader who was much more opposed to the chartering of that particular school building sort of indirectly likened Teach for America and chartering and sort of the direction of the modern reform movement to slavery. And so I was just sort of struck by how, when you're coming at it from those two totally, totally different perspectives, do you even sit down and start to have a conversation? And I think I saw that language gap play out in sort of much more subtle ways in the schools on a daily basis, just in terms of the the words that kids would use and the words that in particular the teachers who were new to the community and had not grown up in New Orleans would use. And a lot of times that made it harder to build relationships just because they weren't speaking in the same language.
Well, and at a very basic level, I mean, you write about there's a scene in this book where the teacher and students are discussing mm-hmm. why it's even important at all to be speaking the same language.
Yeah. No, Aiden, the young teacher who I wrote about, took his students on a number of college trips. And towards the end of the book, there's a scene when they travel to Harvard together. And I think it wasn't so much kind of overt language, but I think it dawns on him over the course of that trip that his students are really coming at sort of the college search process from a very different perspective and might have different goals in mind than the ones that had been inculcated in him since he was very, very young. So in terms of his character, I think that was a real turning point because he started to realize that he's going to have to communicate with students differently and be a little bit more open to ways in which their goals and aspirations might not be his own.
One of the lessons that seems to come out of this that I thought was most interesting was that it was almost like there was a reality check in this for reform-minded people, that even the best and most ambitious efforts of people like Aidan Kelly and Mary Laurie aren't alone always enough to make immediate change.
Yeah, no, I think that was the biggest takeaway for me, and I think is one of the bigger takeaways from the book, that you can sort of make all of these efforts to improve the schools, but if you have a broken healthcare system and a broken criminal justice system and kids who are living in communities where there's a lot of gun violence and have parents who have to work 80 hours a week just to make ends meet, that it's going to be very hard to revitalize a city in the long run, and that there needs to be a much more holistic look at poverty alleviation in this country, and that in New Orleans there needs to be much broader changes than just to the schools.
Well, and I thought one of the most interesting, you know, we talked about the contrast that people might easily set up in their mind between a young, ambitious, almost aggressive teaching system and a veteran who has been in the public school system for years, mm-hmm. where that there might not actually be that much as much separating them as we imagine. The thing that really did seem telling is this contrast between the idea of schools being about doing one thing and doing it especially well and mm-hmm. being about mm-hmm. much more to a neighborhood or a community.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I mean, I do think there are real differences in the educational style and philosophy between Assai Academy, which is the school where Aiden works, and an O'Perry Walker, which is the school led by the veteran principal. But I think that there is, as you hint, this distinction between whether or not schools should really be kind of reflective of their communities and part and parcel of them, or whether or not they're almost kind of add-ons, sort of very much distinct and kind of aimed at kind of lifting students out of a community. And I think that the latter approach there really runs the risk of kind of being somewhat paternalistic, and that is something that reformers in New Orleans and elsewhere need to pay attention to make sure that they're understanding and appreciating the social and cultural context that their students come from.
You're right. It's interesting that even where ambitious and energetic teachers thrive, students still misbehave, performance still sometimes lags, and even those energetic teachers can get tired and see their own morale lag.
Yeah, I think there is a sustainability issue when you have predominantly 20-something teachers who are working 80 hours or 70 hours as a matter of course. And I think that will be a challenge moving forward if you see really high rates of teacher turnover at some of these schools. Another takeaway for me was that I felt like there needed to be more effort made towards creating diverse teaching staffs. In New Orleans, there were a lot of schools that were staffed predominantly by African-American veteran educators from the pre-Katrina schools who looked somewhat askance on some of the newcomers. But then there were others that were sort of all 24-year-olds who were new to New Orleans and to teaching and looked somewhat askance on some of the old-timers. And I don't think there were enough settings where you kind of built on the assets of experience and youthful idealism and enthusiasm at the same time.
Is there a danger in extrapolating too much from New Orleans, in particular the depopulation and slow repopulation of New Orleans is essentially unprecedented?
You know, I really don't think so. I mean, I moved to New Orleans in 2007, so it was 2 years after Katrina. And granted, the city still is rebuilding, and it is an unprecedented situation that faced them. But as I said earlier, I really feel like, having spent time in the schools there, that it speaks to fundamental disagreements about the direction of urban education, not just in that city but across America, and that a lot of the tensions that I see there on a daily basis are the same ones that I saw in my time in Milwaukee reporting.
If there was a key lesson that you think the experiences you chronicle from New Orleans has to offer, perhaps Milwaukee in particular, and maybe the country as a whole, what would you say that key lesson is as education reform remains on the agenda?
I guess two. The first, kind of on a pragmatic level, I was really struck by the importance of school leadership. And there's been so much conversation about teacher quality that's become sort of a buzz phrase in recent years. But I just spent time in charter schools in New Orleans where, depending on the leader, the same staff of teachers could really thrive or flounder. And so I think cities that are trying to improve their schools over time really need to pay a lot of attention to getting compassionate, experienced, knowledgeable school leaders in each of their schools. And the second one, which is one that I've already alluded to, is that we cannot sort of end poverty in this country with a focus that's just on children and schools. It really needs to be a lot broader than that. And I think, for instance, in New Orleans, there really has not been enough attention paid to the adults in the community and their needs. It's sort of like poor adults are like this lost cause. But I think that if you have all these well-intentioned, really hardworking parents that can't play the kind of role that they want to in their kids' lives because they have to work 80 hours in a casino or a hotel just to pay their bills. So I think these efforts need to be a lot more holistic.
Sarah Carr, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Sarah Carr is an education reporter based in New Orleans and formerly wrote about education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her book is called Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. And she spoke with us last year. We'll continue the back-to-school theme with a greening of the Marquette campus when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. There's nobody more excited about today being Marquette University's first day of classes than senior Kyle Welton. It's not just because graduation is within his grasp. Welton helped implement two new green initiatives on campus designed to drive down waste. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met the senior inside Marquette's Alumni Memorial Union at 14th and Wisconsin. She learned about the new programs and about the interesting student.
If he knew the ancient expression, Kyle Welton would agree he is dressed to the nines, from his starched blue dress shirt, tie clip to boot, topped with blue blazer, punctuated with a Marquette University lapel pin. He's out to do his university proud and talk up Marquette's commitment to the triple bottom line.
We want to make sure that, one, it's environmentally friendly. Is it sustainable going in the future? Is it economically sustainable? Is this the cost that we invest in we're going to save in over time? And is it sustainable operation? operationally? Is this something that is going to be able to integrate into what we do here? And Ozzy is certainly one of those things.
Meet Ozzy. From a distance, it looks like your run-of-the-mill vending machine. Au contraire, Welton says, in so many words.
So when we come over to the machine here, the way it works is you touch a screen.
It's designed to suck in sturdy plastic carry-out containers. Each undergrad living in Marquette student housing will receive one upon their arrival. Each food box is individually barcoded.
So when we place it under here,
barcode up,
it scans it.
When Ozzy does not respond, Welton checks with technicians busily preparing for the oncoming onslaught of students.
Do you guys know if Ozzy's fully up and running right now, or if it's...
No. What's
Without missing a beat, okay. Welton improvises and moves on.
What happens is this tray flips up, it goes inside of there. Now, what's smart about these machines is that there are two sensors in here. There's one that says, I'm 75% full. It sends a text message to the manager on duty and says, come empty me. And there's one that says, totally full, we won't take any more containers, you have to come clean me out. And each one holds about, I think it's 250 empty containers.
When a student drops off a used food container, the machine spews out a token.
Right here, you grab that and hold on to it, and then next time when you get this reasonable to-go container, you present that at the point of sale, the cash register.
Where you've already picked up a spanking new container. Welton has anecdotal information indicating Marquette's food service team is already delighted and the system hasn't even been launched yet.
When we put these reusable to-go container machines in, the custodian who works here during the afternoons was so excited. Somebody told me she had tears in her eyes. I don't know if that's true or not, but she...
Something we probably can't fact check.
Yeah.
Undaunted, Welton presses on. He pulls out some preliminary calculations.
Given the day, depending on which day it was during the week, she would pull out anywhere from 35 to 60 trash bags an hour filled with empty to-go containers. So think about the number, and they're not recyclable. Think about the number that's going into landfills.
Part of his excitement comes from the fact that Welton is among a group of students working on this idea since his freshman year.
A lot of that was convincing the Senate that this is worth the investment.
That's Marquette's student government body. It figures centrally in his life. Over the years, Welton has worked his way up its ladder. Last spring, he was elected president.
It's a lot of money. $45,000 is no small chunk of change. That is a year's cost of attendance here at Marquette for one student. So when you put all that together, you've got 33 students sitting there who are evaluating, is this the right thing for my constituents? Do I believe in this? And so that took quite a bit of time, and there was a period we were worried we wouldn't get it through. And if we did, we'd only get one machine, and if that was the case, it wouldn't be very successful.
As you figured out, in the end, Welton and his supporters prevailed.
After a 2.5-hour discussion in the Senate, it was passed with only one dissenting vote.
Student government purchased two reusable dining container systems. Marquette came up with funding for a third to cover multiple dining sites on campus.
It was very, very exciting.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Okay, so now on to water.
Water, yes. So
just steps away, Welton shows me the digital water dispenser unit freshly installed in the student union. 10 more, he says, have been hooked up in convenient locations throughout campus. This time, Welton is successfully able to demonstrate the water system. He screws off the top of his Marquette Blue environmentally friendly reusable water bottle.
You set your water bottle here, it fills it up, and it'll tell you exactly how many disposable plastic water bottles you've helped eliminate from landfills by using a reusable water bottle at these stations.
So it gives you an ongoing count as to what you're doing to add to the effort?
Yeah. So since this was installed, 1,538 disposable plastic water bottles have been eliminated by use of these.
Now, is this something else students get?
Yeah. So what we did was, looking at some unspent funds that we had at the end of the year, we decided to purchase 5,000 of these water bottles. They're BPA-free, and they have been distributed to all students living in the residence halls. So they're going to get a container like this. They're going to get an MUSG water bottle.
Welton says student government reps will spread the conservation word and distribute 1,500 more bottles around campus.
It's one of those things where we can put these out there and hope people use it, or we can put them out there and give them the tools to use it and really see this grow. We've committed to this as an institution. Students should have some skin in the game as well. And we also passed a recommendation earlier on for the university to sign on to a pledge. The name of it escapes me. It's named after one of the saints who was extremely active in stewardship of the earth. And that's one of the tenets, really, of Jesuit pedagogy, is that we're going to be wise stewards of Mother Earth's resources. So as a Catholic Jesuit institution, looking from that perspective as well, how are we going to come together as students and kind of live up to the mission that we've embraced? And I think that this is a really positive way to do that.
Had university leaders been within earshot, they clearly would have awarded Welton high marks. As we head out of the Union, the Sheboygan native says it was the school's political science program that attracted him. Welton interned on Capitol Hill between his sophomore and junior years. But as an incoming freshman, Welton says he knew nothing else of the school, had never paid a visit. Upon arrival, he says Marquette felt like home. Developing a sense of environmental stewardship, Welton says, came naturally.
Not only can we increase our sustainability, but our economic sustainability. It's an incredible way to look at that and say, we're improving the quality of life for, you know, really the entire environment in which we live, but also the future and progress for an institution that we all love so much.
The 21-year-old assures me his views couldn't be more objective. He's a practicing Lutheran. When he graduates, Welton plans to move into public policy.
There's an incredible opportunity to help people on a grand scale in public service and public policy. And that's my dream.
A plan that seems sustainable, no matter what your political background. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Kyle Welton is a Marquette University senior and student government president. You'll find more about the school's new green initiatives from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break and then some insight into what makes a good teacher from, well, a good teacher and her principal. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Last fall, we went out into the field to get some insight into what makes an effective teacher these days, and we reached out to someone who was recognized for being especially effective. Lauren Boyd, an elementary school teacher at Milwaukee College Prep, was last year's winner of the Education Deans of Greater Milwaukee Early Career Award. We sat down with Boyd and her principal at the 38th Street campus, Maggie Olson, to talk about what it takes to succeed at teaching.
I would much rather spend my day with a group of children with all their energy and creativity and desire to really show their best all the time than being in any sort of other setting. This is just, it's a warm place when you walk in the door. My classroom is a warm yet rigorous environment. I really push them, even though I love them, I push them daily beyond their comfort zone to really make sure that they're ready, that they're performing at grade level and above that, and that they're going to be ready to be successful adults or successful middle school students or college students.
Let me ask you this question, Maggie Olson, and that is, you're assembling a group of teachers that is teaching students that might have the deck stacked against them in some ways outside of school, and that's what perhaps brought them here. What is it that makes a good teacher?
We really believe in mission-based hiring at Milwaukee College Prep. When I look in the eyes of the teachers that I'm interviewing and I say, do they love kids? Do they believe? Because everything else we can help them get better at. If you struggle with lesson plans, we can help you get better at writing lesson plans. We can help you be a stronger reading teacher, a stronger math teacher. But what really truly makes a great teacher is that they love kids and they love their job and they work hard. Like, you can love the kids all day long, but if you don't have the work ethic, because we expect a lot. One of our tenets here at Milwaukee College Prep is play hard, work hard. So we play hard. We have a really good time. It's really fun, but the work is really hard. It's hard work to get 401 students quiet to a volume zero after dancing and partying and then going, okay, now we're going to get in a straight line. That takes a lot of time. That takes a lot of practice. And our teachers really hold that high expectation. So it's this really unique balance of high expectations and love. So that's, to me, is the perfect mix for a great teacher.
What did you not know that when you got into this business that you think you get now? I mean, if you were going back 5 years and you were going to talk to the brand new Lauren Boyd teacher, what would you tell her?
I didn't know how important it was to know every single student at their level, their learning level, their life outside of school, their family, building those relationships with them and with whoever is in their family, how critical that is to their success. When they feel loved, connected to you, supported, it helps build those learning connections even better in the classroom.
Well, and one of those things that you just mentioned, the idea knowing the level of each of your students seems like an underrated part of the teaching equation. You're not just teaching second grade, you are teaching second graders who are at a variety of different skill levels. How do you balance the need to challenge the students that are ahead and doing really well with meeting the needs of the kids that need more help with meeting the needs of the kids that are right in the middle?
Right. It is challenging, and those levels can be a wide spectrum, but we have great supports here at Milwaukee College Prep. I have an educational assistant who is integral with pulling out those small groups, both challenging the higher level students and then bringing those up to grade level who aren't quite there. Because as you said, you know, we see a wide range coming in at the same age level, but we have a lot of curriculum support, a lot of guidance with our academic deans and things, and it takes a lot of work, a lot of planning, and just being really organized with everything.
We hear a lot about the challenges that elementary school teachers in particular have with dealing with the number of standardized tests that they have to teach around, and talk about the balance between, you know, trying to get kids to understand what they're going to be tested on with teaching kids that what they're there to do is learn and master the stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to bring it down to their level in, as far as like real life examples and connections, things they already know, things they experience outside of school. Because when you can connect a math concept to when you're shopping at Target, for instance, they understand that or can connect to that better. And then just making it fun. It's definitely challenging, but as much as you can build that fun in there, it makes the rigor a little bit easier for them to handle.
And I also think that when we talk about standardized tests, it's something that happens in our life. To get into college, you have to take the ACT or SAT. To become a teacher, you have to take the Praxis. So it's a life skill to be able to take tests. But our goal is not to get our scholars to be great test takers. Our goal is to get them to be great human beings who are successful in college and beyond. And this is just one of those small things that are going to be a great way to show that they're doing well.
Lauren Boyd is a second grade teacher at Milwaukee College Prep's 38th Street campus. Maggie Olson is the principal. Boyd won the Educational Deans of Greater Milwaukee's Early Career Award last fall, and our interview first aired then. We've covered the academic aspect of education, the sustainability goals of one institution, but we've neglected another important area, back-to-school fashion, as it's reflected in that all-important kindergarten demographic. Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist picks up the story from there.
It's often said that every generation is different. That's only partly true, because here's another expression: what goes around comes around. Let me explain. I've always felt the parental chore of taking a 5-year-old boy to the clothing store for a new pair of pants is like going to the rodeo. It's the closest most of us ever come to roping a calf. And to borrow yet another expression, I've been to that rodeo a few times before, as a kid, a father, and a grandfather. I used to give my saintly mother quite a workout at a children's clothier in Shorewood, Kitty Campus, as I recall. Being forced to try on a stack of pants there would send my body into a series of contortions, from passive resistance to bended knee, hopping on one foot, and the classic pose of hiding under the clothing rack. So, on a recent trip to the mall with my daughter and grandson, I sensed what was coming, especially when our conversation turned to boys' pants. Feeling confident that I knew all the tricks, I offered to help size them up. "Come on, Max, this won't be so bad," I said. Through the swinging half door and into the changing corral we went. Let the rodeo begin. We hopped, skipped, and a few times even lost our balance. Not quite a blue ribbon performance, but entertaining enough. In fact, a gathering of sales associates, curious moms, and kids was taking it all in. Six changes, and 15 minutes later, we both emerged with our dignity and a couple of new pants for the road. On the way out, my daughter Holly could only smile. "I'm surprised he was so good," she told me. "Why?" I asked. "Because I had him try on 8 pairs of pants this morning." Moms don't change that much either.
Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist is a television producer in Milwaukee. That's the Monday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. And don't forget your protractor, your compass, and plenty of #2 pencils. Have a great day. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.